The following program is produced and furnished in conjunction with Derek Dorch of the Diversa Group, which is entirely responsible for its content.
Welcome to Fed Access with Derek T. Dorch on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Derek walks you through how to win government jobs and contracts, effectively manage your government career, and best utilize government services. Every week on Fed Access, you'll learn about interesting federal agencies, workers, and jobs. Fed Access provides you the access you need to succeed in the federal government. And now your host, Derek T. Dorch.
Welcome to Fed Access with Derek T. Dorch on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Thank you for coming by the show. Today we're going to be talking about some recent developments that's been going on. As people have been monitoring the news, they've been seeing some things that's going on in Mexico. A drug kingpin, so to say, Guzman has escaped over the past several days. And people are wondering, how did this happen? How did he get out of jail? The corruption in Mexico. People were talking about a dynamic of that the DEA wanted to bring him and extradite them to the United States and put him in a supermax prison. Why didn't this happen? What are the implications of his escape? Is this going to expand any kind of drug cartels? Is this going to expand any kind of violence in Mexico that may also cross over into our borders, which we've seen over in Texas and other border states as well? And will this also be an expansion of the drug trade into the United States and elsewhere? There are a lot of different questions that we're answering today. We've got Scott Stewart on. He's a vice president of tactical analysis at Stratfor. You can find them at stratfor.com, but they're their private intelligence firm. They focus on a lot of geopolitical issues, a number of different security issues, a number of national security issues, but they cover things and they always monitor it, not only for government agencies, but multinational corporations, nonprofits, and everybody else. Scott, thank you so much for being on the show.
Hey, thanks for having me on, Derek.
Scott, you know, you've been monitoring this situation for a long time. What's the implication of Chapo Guzman? What's, you know, this whole escape, what's your thoughts on it and what are the implications of it?
Well, one of the big things that I'd like to start out with is that, you know, we need to understand that the dynamic in Mexico for the past several years has been that we've had this, what we call a Stratfor, the balkanization of organized crime in Mexico, or basically what we have are the large organizations breaking down into smaller parts. Really, if you look, it goes all the way back to the dissolution of the Guadalajara cartel into the units that became known as, you know, the Ariana Felix organization in Tijuana, the Juarez cartel, the Sinaloa cartel. But really, since that time, there's been a steady breakdown of these larger organizations into smaller parts. And we've also seen that with Sinaloa over the last several years. And it's very important to note that even before we had Guzman arrested last year in 2014, we saw his organization breaking down as important segments or, you know, important subgroups left. You know, the first one of those was the Beltran Leyva organization. You know, they were also a very powerful Sinaloa-based, you know, drug group. And they broke off and kind of started a war with the rest of Sinaloa and actually started, you know, working with Los Zetas and some others. But then we also saw them lose Ignacio Coronel's organization after it was believed that Guzman had betrayed Coronel. So there's been just a steady trickle of these groups leaving. And, you know, that preceded even Guzman going into prison. So anybody who's thinking that, you know, him coming out of prison, he's going to be able to put all those pieces back together again, I believe are mistaken. I just don't think that he has the capability to reconstruct what we thought of the Sinaloa cartel, you know, 7 or 10 years ago.
You know,
another important thing to remember is, you know, he was able to plan this very sophisticated attack from his jail cell, or not attack, escape from his jail cell. So if he was able to, you know, plan this escape, don't you think he was also able to kind of, you know, run his organization while he was in prison? I believe he was. So I think that you know, people who say, well, you know, Sinaloa is on hard times just because El Chapo was in jail, I think that they're really misinformed and kind of, you know, are reading into the myth that is El Chapo, that he's, you know, a larger-than-life individual.
You know, you make a great point in terms of, one, he was able to plan this escape while he was in jail. And this thing, as the details are coming out, this seems to be kind of massive. What's the corruption dynamic in terms of the government officials, prison officials, the police, and everything else? That's always been a notorious issue in Mexico. Is it just as strong today that the corruption levels to allow an escape of this magnitude to happen? Is it just as bad, or has it gotten better, worse? What's going on?
Well, certainly the government has been working to cure it, but it's a huge problem, and it's not just in Mexico, and that's something that we as Americans need to remember. You know, we've had a lot of corruption on this side of the border. We've had, you know, FBI agents in charge of field offices, taken down in El Paso. We've had sheriffs taken down, you know, numerous sheriffs taken down in Texas. So it really is an issue on this side of the border as well. And it just goes back to the fact that these organizations, you know, have so much money, but also they have some pretty sophisticated players. You know, these aren't just, corner street dealers. They have people working for them who are fairly sophisticated. And one of the things I like to draw kind of a parallel to, when we look at corruption in this context, we need to kind of think about it almost more as a counterintelligence problem than just a corruption problem, because these guys are very slick, they're very targeted, and really they have resources and finances that rival many intelligence agencies. And so they're able to kind of go in, target the people that they need to target, and recruit them and pay them and get the information that they wanted. Even in this escape by Guzman from Altiplano prison, you know, everybody's been focused on the fact that, you know, it was an engineering marvel, which it was. I mean, think about it. They were able to, you know, have this tunnel a mile long that ended up exactly in his shower. I mean, you know, that is very good engineering.
Right.
but at the same time, in order to complete that engineering feat, they needed to have very specific and very excellent intelligence. And so when we look at it that way, we can start to walk back the cat and figure out, you know, who had access, you know, to this very specific information, and then try to figure out, you know, almost like a counterintelligence case, who was responsible for the leaks. And it didn't necessarily have to be widespread. You know, there could have been one or two key individuals that could have provided the information necessary, you know, for such an escape.
Right. You know, I've always wondered, Scott, I mean, are we underestimating these cartels? And you just kind of hit it on the head right there. I was reading an article saying that in one city, they were taking down cameras that some of the cartels had installed to monitor certain things, or whatever the case is, or sophisticated cameras around the city, and they had to kind of remove these cameras. You know, you just mentioned these cartels are bringing in billions of dollars, millions and billions of dollars, and they're bringing in some of the top talent, whether it be computer or security or otherwise. Have we underestimated these guys for a long time?
Well, I think in some aspects, yes. And specifically in this corruption aspect, I think we have, and we really need to think of them more like a hostile intelligence agency and less like, you know, common criminals.
Mm-hmm.
Because they have the resources, and they have some very sophisticated people that they've hired, not only from within their own country and their own government. They've hired a lot of former military guys, former cops, former intelligence people, but also from outside. We have a lot of reports of them hiring, you know, special forces officers and enlisted guys from Guatemala, from El Salvador, other places in the region, bringing in trainers from Israel and other countries. And in fact, we've even seen, some of the cartels recruit some American former soldiers and former Marines to help with their training and operations.
Hmm.
So, you know, they have the resources to be able to hire people, to put the teams together that are very professional, very competent.
You know, I was always wondering, Scott, with this whole dynamic of, you know, we're seeing a lot of our U.S. States kind of talk about the decriminalization of marijuana and other areas like that. You know, Colorado, I've seen it in other states where marijuana is not being seen as much as a drug that the DEA or local police is going after. What's your take? I mean, what are you seeing? I mean, is this change of the game in terms of decriminalization changing the level in which the drugs are coming over? Is it changing the scope? Is it changing profits? I mean, what are you seeing in terms of that?
Well, I think that in one aspect, it's going to make it very difficult for the cartels, because it's going to cut into their marijuana sales.
Mm-hmm.
And marijuana has always been, you know, an important cash crop for them, but it's not their only cash crop. And, you know, in the past, we've seen shifts as, you know, basically America's drug taste switch. We'll see drugs become more or less popular. Think about the way that the Mexicans were kind of ahead of the wave as far as meth goes. And, you know, they were kind of able to seize that. And as, you know, U.S. law enforcement was clamping down on, you know, meth manufacturing in the U.S., the Mexicans took advantage of that and cranked it up, no pun intended, big time in order to be able to produce not only huge quantities of methamphetamine, but very, very high quality stuff, you know, a lot higher quality than what some of the biker gangs and others were creating. So we'll see the same thing going with other drug mixtures as well. You know, we're going to see them producing more and more of the black tar heroin and trafficking that as opiates become, you know, more popular here. So they're very adaptive. They have a history of being adaptive. And there's no reason to think that, you know, the legalization of marijuana, even if it went broad scale, is going to impact their operations and profits. The other thing where we've seen several cases, and specifically in Colorado, I'm thinking, where we've had arrests of people who were trying to use these legal marijuana outlets to launder drug money for the Mexican cartel. So basically, these cartels were seeing, you know, this legal marijuana as a venue for them to invest and launder their money.
So they're going to still can't stay in the business regardless, whether it be legalized or not. They're going to still make sure they get a piece of it.
Yeah.
We're talking to Scott Stewart. We're talking about what's going on in Mexico. We're talking about the Guzman escape. We're talking about the implications of everything, the cartels, the drug business, the border issues that are going on in Mexico right now. These are things that sometimes are not covered and now is back in the news because of the Guzman escape. But a lot of times it's not where it should be in terms of a national security issue, and it needs to be. We're talking about all these things with Scott Stewart from Strat 4 right now. We'll be right back after this break. You're listening to Fed Access with Derek T. Dorch on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Welcome back to Fed Access with Derek T. Dorch on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. If you're just joining us, we're talking about Mexico. We're talking about what's going on in the area, the drug cartels, the Guzman escape, the implications of the border issues, of immigration issues, and everything else that's going on in Mexico. This has always been an issue of national security, an issue of homeland security, an issue of kind of drug control. But there's a lot of implications that's going on. It's been in the headlines right now. We've been covering it for a long time on Fed Access, but we're talking about it today again. We've got Scott Stewart on. He is the Vice President of Tactical Analysis at Strat 4. Strat 4 is one of our regular guests. You can find them at strat4.com, but they are a private intelligence firm. They focus in on all sectors around the world, but they understand Mexico because it's in their backyard. They're right in Austin, Texas. They know this situation, and they know this topic well, more than anybody else. Scott, when we look at this situation and we think about kind of the dynamics of the U.S. role in this. You know, DEA was saying we've had intelligence about this for a long time. The Mexicans said that they didn't, you know, Mexico said that they didn't get it. You know, everybody's saying, well, he should have been brought to the U.S. and put in a supermax prison. What is our role and how engaged? And then would that have changed anything if he was brought over here and put into a prison?
Well, you know, certainly that is the contention. And you know, we're seeing you know, we haven't seen any tunnels dug under Florence, Colorado with the Supermax there.
Right.
And you know, it's highly doubtful. But really, you know, there's a sovereignty issue there. And there's always a little bit of tension, frankly, between, you know, U.S.-Mexico relations because of the history and the long history there. You know, in many ways, Mexico kind of sees, you know, U.S. as the aggressive big brother. And so they kind of, you know, we'll bridle back a little bit out of kind of, you know, national pride and sovereignty and say, you know, let us do our thing. You know, we're Mexicans. And to their point, you know, to now, they haven't had any escapes from Altiplano, you know, their high security prison. And perhaps they got a little overconfident, you know, in the security there. But certainly I don't believe you know, that Guzman would have been able to escape, you know, had he been in U.S. custody. But there's a number of you know, high-profile people in Mexico right now that the U.S. is trying to get at. You know, we would very much like to have, you know, Edgar Villarreal, La Barbie, brought up here. You know, he's actually an American citizen. There, you know, and there are some other drug lords. Actually, about almost a year ago, we had another major drug lord, a guy, Cano Quintero, Rafael Cano Quintero, who was one of the heads of the Guadalajara cartel, and he was put in jail, in Mexican jail, due to his role in the killing of U.S. Drug Enforcement Agent Enrique Camarena, or Kiki Camarena, and the Americans were livid that basically Caro Quintero was able to, you know, basically wheedle and bribe his way out of prison. And, you know, they've been hunting him down ever since, but they haven't had any success. So this is kind of rubbing a little bit more salt into that already open wound. That said, you know, while the Americans are angry right now about this, there's, you know, little they can do. They have to work with the Americans. You know, it's kind of like a marriage here. You know, you have to work with your partner. You have to try to reconcile. You have to try to improve things. So, you know, in the long run, I don't think this is going to have a huge impact on U.S.-Mexico relations, you know, and on the war against drugs. I think that, you know, cooperation is going to continue, but certainly this is a sore spot.
You know, we keep on, and of course, as the political tensions rise, and we're seeing this thing in the debate cycle of politics right now, whether it be immigration issues and the border issues and everything else. You guys monitor Mexico a lot in terms of what's going on economically, what's going on with the drug wars, what's going on with the border issues. What are you seeing right now? Is there improvement? Is this a dynamic that, you know, things are turning, although we've seen this escape situation, but are things turning for the better, or has it been stagnant, or has it gotten worse?
Well, I think we as far as the violence issue, you know, it does seem that the Mexicans have had, you know, pretty good luck in quenching violence in many places that were very hot. You know, for example, Juarez today, you know, is 1,000 times better than it was in 2010. You know, a lot of businesses are coming back there. Things are being revitalized. You know, the local police department has kind of been rebuilt and is now competent. So you know, there are definitely places, you know, where things are getting better. But at the same time, there are still places where things are pretty bad. And you know, Michoacan, Guerrero, even Tamaulipas now. And so there are, you know, still areas that the Mexican government, as the federal government, but also at, you know, state and local levels, really have a lot of work to do. But, you know, at the bottom line, though, you know, looking at this in politics, one of the things that we're kind of, as Americans, are hesitant to admit or to look at is, frankly, the reason that we have the flow of all these illicit materials into our country and all these poisons, these narcotics, is because there's a demand here.
Right.
If you weren't willing to pay big money, you know, for, you know, an ounce of cocaine, or methamphetamine, or whatever else, they wouldn't move it. They wouldn't take the risks. But as long as we have the demand that we have here, and as long as these products bring the prices that they bring, we're going to have people find new and creative ways to smuggle them into our country.
Right.
And, you know, they will use basically any means. You know, they will go, you know, when we build border fences, they'll go under the fence or over the fence, or they'll find another weak spot by, you know, bribing a border guard, you know, one of the lane officers, you know, directing traffic, things like that. So they're very ingenious, and they'll find new ways as long as the demand is there. And it's basically the same thing with illegal immigration. You know, as long as people from, you know, South Central America and Mexico can come to the United States and get jobs, you know, with ease, they'll continue to come here to meet that demand that's there. So until we kind of take care of our business here as a country, you know, we can't blame everything on the Mexicans.
You know, you touch on an excellent point, because demand is there for drugs, and it's something that we really have not addressed. You don't hear it in the political cycle. You really don't hear too much being done about it. You know, I mean, there are a couple drug treatment things and things like that, but it's really not a conversation point. And even with Mexico, we're seeing a little bit of economic improvement, but we're not really seeing the economic development in Mexico in terms of jobs and other resources that we need to see to allow, you know, people to say, well, you know, I got more opportunity here than going to the United States. Are we, Scott? I mean, it's still...
No,
it's still
that is changing.
Okay, okay.
I mean, their economy has been growing very rapidly. A lot of that is due to NAFTA.
Okay.
I mean, it's been interesting. It's not only at low-end manufacturing stuff, but we've seen a lot of high-end manufacturing, you know, autos, you know, automobiles, high-end electronics, and other things. So really, we've seen a lot of economic growth, and not just along the border.
Okay.
In these maquiladoras, in places like Juarez and Tijuana, but we've also seen, down south, in central Mexico, Carretero, and there's been a lot of economic development and very impressive economic development. And, you know, a lot of these companies then, believe it or not, a lot of Mexican companies are actually, you know, starting to become more active in the United States. You know, brands like Bimbo, which is a big bread company.
Mm-hmm.
I think that Mexico is on an upward trajectory economically. I think that probably, I don't have the latest numbers in front of me, but I think that we're going to start to see that reflected also, in immigration flows as well. You know, I believe that we're going to see, you know, many more people from Central America, where there's a lot less economic activity, than from Mexico, where there's more promise.
So it almost seems as if, I mean, maybe in the next 10, 20 years, we may see a kind of a changeover in terms of kind of economic development, and maybe even the tide of immigration may kind of, you know, flow back to kind of say, well, I need, you know, I've got opportunities in Mexico. I don't need to go
or,
anywhere.
Or at least stabilize. Or, you know, people from Central America working in Mexico. I that's where we see it going as a company when Stratfor looks at Mexico. You know, we're advising a lot of our clients to invest there. Because we see, I mean, the violence is a problem, certainly. You know, I don't want to downplay that at all, especially as a security guy. But really, I see it as being, you know, something that's going to be contained. And as the country gets their act together with these reforms, I think they're going to be able to turn the corner. And, I think that we're going to see them turn the corner with, you know, the violence issue, much as we've seen the Colombians be able to, you know, to dial in their cartels in the past, and make sustained progress. And, you know, now as the country's gone and, you know, passed education reform and energy reform, and some of these other difficult things, it's going to give them some momentum so that they can fix, their law enforcement and security issues. Are they ever going to be able to totally eradicate crime? We can't do that in America.
Right.
You know, we still have, very active criminal groups here and organized crime groups. You know, everybody from, you know, the mafia to MS-13 to biker gangs are still here. And even with, you know, the advanced techniques and technology of American law enforcement, we haven't been able to, you know, eradicate organized crime. So it's always going to be an issue there. I guess the big thing for the Mexicans is just reducing the violence to a more tolerable level. So it's more like, you know, the United States than it is the Honduras.
We've been talking to Scott Stewart. He's the vice president of tactical analysis, and he's given us some hope for Mexico. It sounds like something we got to keep on monitoring, keep on staying abreast on. It seems as if there may be an economic development, a changeover, that some improvements that are happening in Mexico. And even though we're dealing with this drug issue and border issues, that maybe in the next 10, 20 years, we're hopefully going to see some positive change. Scott, thank you for this insight. We're going to keep on monitoring it and always check back in with you as new developments continue to happen. Next on Fed Access, we're going to be talking to Mark Schroeder. He's Vice President of International Operations, and he's from Stratfor as well. But we're going to turn the tide and turn the conversation to Africa. What's going on with the International Criminal Court? What's going on with Boko Haram? What's going on in terms of Africa and any kind of concerns of terrorism and everything else? We'll be right back after this break. You've been listening to Fed Access with Derek T. Dorch on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Welcome back to Fed Access with Derek T. Dorch on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. If you're just joining us, we have been having an interesting conversation. The first half of the show dealt with talking about Mexico, talking about Guzman and his recent escape, talking about the implications of the drug cartels and Guzman's escape. Will there be a rise of the cartels? Will there be a number of different dynamics that will continue to happen in Mexico, either good or bad? Will this guy be caught again? So definitely tune back into that show and listen to that. But we're going to shift gears, and we're going to go into Africa. If people have been paying attention, there's a number of different things that's going on in Africa, Boko Haram and a number of other things. But a small news story came out recently about a number of African countries kind of moving away from the ICC, the International Criminal Court. We want to find out and get some analysis on that and find out why they're doing that and what are the implications of doing that. We're talking to Mark Schroeder. He is the Vice President of International Operations from Stratfor. Again, you can find Stratfor on stratfor.com, but they're a private intelligence firm that focuses in on a number of worldwide issues. They analyze it, they monitor it, they provide analysis that they give to multinational corporations, government agencies, nonprofits, NGOs, and everybody else who needs that analysis. Mark, hey, thanks for coming on Fed Access.
Great, Derek. Thanks for having me back on your program.
Always glad to have you. Hey, talk to us about this Africa situation. This was, I don't know if it necessarily got a lot of play in the news, but it seemed to be something really, really important about African countries moving away from the ICC, the International Criminal Court. What's going on?
Sure. And what happened was there was an African Union summit that had taken place in South Africa, in Johannesburg, a few weeks ago, and the Sudanese president, along with every other president from Africa, had been invited to attend. And the Sudanese president is, you know, under indictment by the International Criminal Court for alleged war crimes being that took place in Sudan's Darfur region. And so the South African government was under pressure, and calls were made for the South African government to detain and arrest President Bashir of Sudan when he was arriving in the country to attend that African Union summit. The South African government turned around and said, no way, we're not going to arrest the Sudanese president. It's a volunteer mechanism to comply with the International Criminal Court, and the South African government made the point that, you know, there is immunity for all leaders to attend African Union summits such as the one in South Africa. And so at the end of the day, kind of a big controversy arose over, you know, the role of the International Criminal Court, the role of countries who are signatories to the International Criminal Court, and you know, what should be done with, you know, leaders who, you know, who are being investigated for, you know, their role in you know, atrocities haven't been committed in their countries. And so it just brought up a big question on the International Criminal Court. You know, previous to this incident with the Sudanese president in South Africa, there had been other controversial cases, like the Kenyan government and the current Kenyan deputy president also facing investigation by the International Criminal Court for elections-related violence that they may have been involved in a few years ago. And so to African governments, or a number of African governments right now, you know, they are pushing back against this international institution and saying they are unfairly focusing too much effort, and in fact, all of their effort pretty much, on just dealing with a handful of conflict issues, and all in Africa. And the argument from some of these African governments is, you know, we should be looking at, you know, the whole world, and there's a lot of conflicts and a lot of crises going on in the world, and why is this institution focusing, you know, so much attention, if not all of their attention, on just a small number of, you know, limited conflicts in Africa? That's the argument that they are trying to make, and really resisting cooperation with the International Criminal Court.
Is this a game changer, Mark? Is this now, you know, if the African countries start to say, and you know, hey, listen, you're paying too much attention to what's going on here and not making it fair and balanced around the world, we're not going to participate in some of these things. You know, there's definitely been times where, you know, there have been some African leaders and leaders around in a number of different places who have used corruption, who have used certain levels of tyranny and killing and everything else, extortion and all the other things, and have done some bad things in certain countries. Is this going to kind of change the dynamics as we begin to look at the economic development issues in Africa, look at terrorism in certain countries, look at kind of a dynamic of like a Sudanese conflicts between two current countries? What is this? What's the implications of this?
Sure, in a way, it does change the game. It's the voices of African governments that are opposing the International Criminal Court or criticizing the International Criminal Court right now are far louder than the voices of governments that are in favor of the International Criminal Court, and so what you have is a certain momentum taking place that is really resistant to cooperation with the International Criminal Court. And what that means is, you know, is a lot of things kind of will get swept under the carpet, and you know, legitimate atrocities that are taking place are going to be you know, uninvestigated because there's not the political support, you know, to cooperate with the International Criminal Court. And there might be, you know, other cases where, you know, it's not clear if there's, you know, a genuine conflict or genuine atrocities being committed by, you know, by a sovereign government, for example. You know, but in any case, with less and less enthusiasm to cooperate and support the International Criminal Court, and this comes from, you know, from a variety of interests and backgrounds, you know, there's just going to be, you know, less enforcement mechanism or capability to, you know, bring to bear those who are conducting or carrying out, you know, atrocities in various conflict zones across the continent.
You know, it kind of even, you know, makes me think about certain things that if this is the case, you know, where you have a number of different countries, you know, that say, hey, listen, because from what I'm reading about it, 122 countries are part of this kind of thing. But if one continent or a number of different countries in one continent says, hey, we're not going to do this anymore, then that may have implications for other places in Latin, you know, I mean, other countries to say, hey, we're not going to do it either. You know, I mean, it can start a ripple effect and then start changing the dynamic of how we prosecute possibly people who need to be prosecuted around the world.
It sure could. I guess the International Criminal Court really has to kind of take a look at themselves right now. In a way, they've focused on kind of the states that, you know, can't really resist the International Criminal Court in a sense. It's, you know, they've focused much of their effort on dealing with African conflicts and, you know, and not focusing so much on conflicts taking place in other regions of the world. And so if Africa as a whole walks away from the International Criminal Court, you know, what's left for the International Criminal Court to really, you know, focus on if they really don't have any kind of interest or attention placed in other regions of the world, and if they're not getting any traction in Africa, you know, you have to raise the question, you know, what are they really, you know, worthy of?
Right. There's a lot of different dynamics going on. I want to kind of keep monitoring. I definitely got to have you back, Mark. What's the situation right now? Are we seeing that, you know, this is going to happen, or this just kind of a conversation, you know, in terms of maybe kind of the threat of that we're not going to be? I mean, where do you think this is going to go, Mark?
Yeah, right now it's at that conversation level. Okay. So as an international institution, the International Criminal Court, you know, has a momentum of its own, and it's you know, you can understand bureaucracies no matter where they are. It's you know, they live their own life, and it's very difficult to, you know, kind of bring an end to them. And so there will still be a degree of institutional support for the International Criminal Court, but in Africa, but in a practical sense, you know, it's difficult for it to get the necessary political support to really, you know, take a lead and enforce investigation measures to, you know, have any kind of measurable impact on resolving conflicts or bringing, you know, those responsible for conflicts, you know, to bear. So it's a conversation level right now, but, you know, it won't help the ICC's case of, you know, prosecuting those behind conflicts in Africa.
And I see that we are kind of maybe a little bit quiet now because we're not even a part of the ICC. I mean, I'm looking at the different states and everything else. I mean, the United Kingdom and other places are, but we have not necessarily, I don't know if we support it or not, but the United States is not necessarily one of the members of that court.
That's correct. The United States did not want to become a signatory member, and there are constitutional reasons for doing so. But essentially, you know, the United States does not recognize third-party jurisdiction over American citizens.
Right. Right. A lot of different things to seem that can be happen with this as we monitor the ICC and everything else. When we come back, we're going to be talking about Boko Haram. We're going to be talking about what's going on. There's a lot of different things that are happening right now. We thought that situation might improve with the new elections, but it really hasn't. A number of different attacks, even as of recent, there have been a number of attacks within the country and some changes that the Nigerian president has been happening. What are the implications of Boko Haram as a terrorist organization? They've pledged allegiance to ISIS and everything else. We're going to continue this conversation as we continue to talk to Mark Schroeder. He's the vice president of international operations at Stratfor. Stratfor is a private intelligence firm. You can find them at stratfor.com. They cover all the worldwide issues, have great intelligence and analysis on their site that you can get some of it for free, some of it for subscription, but definitely it's worth it to understand what's going on around the world. We'll be right back after this break. You're listening to Fed Access with Derek T. Dorch on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Welcome back to Fed Access with Derek T. Dorch on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. If you're just joining us, we have been talking about a number of different issues. Earlier in the show, we were talking about Mexico. We were talking about the Guzman escape. We were talking about the drug cartels. In this segment of the show, we've been talking about Africa. A number of African countries have decided to move away from the International Criminal Court. Possibly. They've been having discussions about that. We've been talking about the implications of that. But we're going to be talking about now Boko Haram. We've discussed this before on Fed Access, but it's a topic in terms of terrorism that we'd like to try to stay abreast of because it's important. Nigeria is a country that has a lot of ties in terms of the international community, whether it be China, Russia, oil resources, America, and everyone else. But Boko Haram is a terrorist organization that has now been doing a number of different attacks. They've kidnapped a number of women and children. They've done attacks in mosques and other things like that. We want to find out what's going on. We're talking to Mark Schroeder. He's vice president of international operations at Stratfor, a private intelligence firm. You can find them at stratfor.com. Mark, what's going on with Boko Haram right now? I just saw that the president of Nigeria has tried to fire some of his military leaders and said that you're not doing enough. What's this current situation?
So President Buhari of Nigeria did, in fact, reshuffle all of his service chiefs from the branches of the Nigerian Armed Forces, and really in response to the demands of the new Nigerian government to really improve the counterinsurgency against Boko Haram. So President Buhari, he's been in office for roughly 6 weeks now, and his very first marching order upon becoming president was to bring in his service chiefs and tell them, you know, we need to tackle Boko Haram. Mm-hmm. And some gains have been made. The territory that Boko Haram used to be able to control up in the north of Nigeria, you know, that's been reversed. But what we've seen is Boko Haram accommodate themselves to the conventional military offensive against them and to transition towards a counterinsurgency behavior, and specifically to conducting a pretty widespread campaign of suicide bombings. And suicide bombings have been taking place in a pretty diverse set of geography in Nigeria, from kind of north central regions to the northeast to the northwest. And it's quite a concern to the Nigerian government and more importantly to the Nigerian population, who had high hopes in the new Nigerian government coming into office that they were going to reverse the gains made by Boko Haram. But unfortunately, you know, the terror by Boko Haram continues, you know, to be felt, you know, throughout Nigeria.
Mark, you just hit it right there in terms of the issue. A lot of people thought that, this was something that was just going against the Christian government, that this was something that just Good Luck Jonathan was going to be dealing with. And then maybe with now a Muslim government, those from the north coming and everything else into power. I mean, some people thought, well, this is going to be a changeover. With this now not being the case, what does Boko Haram want? I mean, what are they looking for? If not political, people thought it's about political change, but what do they want as an organization?
Sure. Well, you know, part of it is to demonstrate that even with this high-profile change in government, you know, Boko Haram is still a threat to the Nigerian population and Nigerian officials in the northern regions of the country. And so, you know, they have been successful in demonstrating, you know, that they are still a viable militant group, you know, that can terrorize the Nigerian population. But Boko Haram, you know, clearly has faced conventional setbacks. They're no longer a threat to the state. They don't control vast swaths of territory like they did under the previous Nigerian government under former President Goodluck Jonathan. So right now, Boko Haram is probably trying to find their way again. You know, how do they continue to play the role of a militant group when kind of the space around them has been constrained, but yet they are still, you know, a potent terrorist force, especially when you look at the pace of suicide bombings that they're able to conduct.
You know, as we thought about this and you know, with ISIS, I mean, everybody has talked about ISIS. There was a big deal being made of their allegiance with ISIS. Was that more for show, or was that a strategic dynamic to kind of say, you know, we want to be on the same page with ISIS? We want to now kind of bring Africa and, you know, or Nigeria and Iraq together, and then now start taking ISIS, you know, over into Africa a little bit more. Where was that going?
Yeah, I would characterize that as more of a rhetorical position by Boko Haram, because when you look at the battlefield of Boko Haram, you know, they're not attracting transnational jihadists, you know, to come there. They're not, you know, fighting, you know, pitched conventional battles against the Nigerian government. You know, they're no threat to take over the Nigerian state. When you compare that to, you know, the battles that are going on in Syria and Iraq and Yemen and elsewhere, where you are seeing, you know, very robust conventional battles where the actual state is being threatened, and foreign fighters are being attracted to supplement the local ranks, you know, in those distant battle spaces. You know, Nigeria is not in that category. You know, the Pledge of Allegiance to ISIS has not translated into any kind of shift in material support or any kind of improvement in material support. And as a conventional force, they've been considerably degraded, but, you know, they're still alive, and that's why we've seen this shift towards these more terrorist style attacks of suicide bombings, which are, you know, horrific to the Nigerian civilian population.
Right. Do you think with this change and as you've mentioned in the maybe a little bit of the decline of Boko Haram, I mean, do you think we're at the next tide of the game with this? I mean, do you think that the strategy of maybe kind of bringing in new military leaders and also with them losing massive amounts of ground and maybe capabilities maybe in the next several years, will we see the eradication? I mean, hopefully the eradication, but do you think that the tide is changing in terms of the politics, the people, and everything else where Boko Haram will continue to lose its momentum?
Well, certainly there is a lot more political and military support, not only in Nigeria, but among the neighboring countries there and even among the international community to really, you know, counter Boko Haram. And that support and will is going to stay in place for the time to come. But at the same time, you know, there is, you know, a long-standing and deep, you know, river of, you know, radical Islam in northern Nigeria and in this part of West Africa. And those, you know, those tendencies and ideologies cannot be, you know, overturned or eliminated in any kind of short-term frame of mind. And so you might be able to disrupt and degrade the militant organization, but in terms of the ideology that they feed into, it's, you know, that theme is still going to be present in Nigeria. We just hope that the military capability and the political will to support national and regional military forces, you know, is going to be, you know, enough to prevent Boko Haram from, you know, ever returning to the coherent force it once was.
Mark, we only got a little time left, but I want to get a kind of a overview of Africa. You know, we still have situations a little bit going in Somalia and Kenya. You know, we've have AFRICOM. We've got a number of different resources from the United States kind of put into the region to think about Africa, not only from a dynamic of special operations, but international development and everything else. Are we seeing a little bit more stabilization in terms of the continent with certain areas that we were concerned about? Or are the concerns about terrorism and other conflicts still very much on the table?
Well, you know, that's a great question. I would say in some conflict zones, you know, we've seen improvements, you know, such as in Mali or Somalia, mm-hmm. where militant groups there are not the same strategic coherent threat that they once was, they once were. You know, Al-Shabaab in Somalia, you know, also had to go through a difficult transition from, you know, having been a militant organization occupying, you know, considerable geography of that country. And now, you know, now it doesn't occupy the same kind of territory, but it still is very, very capable of conducting terrorist attacks within Somalia and across borders, especially in Kenya, as that country knows, you know, only too well. Over in Mali, the French and other West African forces are still doing peace enforcement operations there to try to make sure the Al-Qaeda franchise in that part of Africa, you know, can't recover its strategic capability. And the French and others want to make sure, you know, Mali, you know, can still remain stable. And that's an improvement over, you know, what that battle space looked like a couple of years ago. But despite all of this, you know, we still have these militant groups. Al-Shabaab is still, you know, a terrorist threat. Al-Qaeda and Islamic Maghreb is still a terrorist threat. Boko Haram is still a terrorist threat. So we're still dealing with, you know, multiple threats across the continent. But there are, you know, smart and capable resources that have been mobilized, you know, to try to disrupt and interdict these threats.
We've been talking to Mark Schroeder. He is from Stratfor. He is the Vice President of International Operations, getting an assessment of what's going on in Africa, not only Boko Haram, not only the International Criminal Court, but also just the whole continent, certain areas of conflict, seeing some improvements, but there's still a long way to go in order to bring stabilization and peace and also economic development to these countries. Mark, thank you so much for giving us these insights.
Derek, thanks so much for having me on your program again.
You've been listening to Fed Access with Derek T. Dortch on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show or any of our weekly programs anytime at federalnewsradio.com. Fed Access with Derek T. Dortch, only on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.